Welcome to the Real Estate Espresso Podcast, your morning shot of what's new in the world of real estate investing. I'm your host, Victor Menashe. On today's show, we're talking about inclusionary zoning. This is a new initiative in many communities aimed at creating affordable housing. The actual goal of inclusionary zoning varies from one community to another. In some locations, there is a narrative that single-family detached homes creates an economic divide and therefore widens racial segregation that's implicit with economically segregated neighborhoods. You won't find an affordable home in the middle of a neighborhood surrounded by luxury homes. Even if a few affordable homes were to exist in that hot neighborhood, they wouldn't last very long. It'd only be a matter of time before someone buys that affordable property, tears it down, and then replaces it with another McMansion. In other communities, the definition of inclusionary zoning is aimed at creating affordable housing by effectively taxing developers with the burden of building a number of affordable units in exchange for the right to build a number of market-rate homes. The theory is that by sprinkling affordable housing throughout the city as part of new development projects, you prevent the ghetto effect of lower-income areas separated from the more affluent areas. Inclusionary zoning programs vary widely in their implementation. In some cases, developers may have the option of building affordable units in other locations within the city, or they might be able to pay cash instead of developing the affordable units. One of the most central tenets of inclusionary zoning is to effectively leverage developers and market dynamics to create housing options for people with lower incomes in the same housing complex as people with higher incomes. In this way, the policy aims to create social mixing and integration, which has proven to negate the propagation of poverty and strengthen social mobility. It is a commendable outcome that we should try to pursue. However, the way that inclusionary zoning has been implemented in most communities has not proven to effectively create enough housing options to have a strong impact on structural segregation. In cities that have tremendously high wait lists for social or affordable housing, inclusionary zoning has not led to the creation of enough housing to meet demand. For example, in New York City, inclusionary zoning has produced only about 172 units a year in the program's first 25 years. Mayor Bloomberg had a more successful voluntary inclusionary zoning program that included generous tax incentives. That program succeeded in creating about 360 units of affordable housing per year over an 8-year period. But when you consider that New York City has a population over 8 million, that's a drop in the bucket. Even with inclusionary zoning, the waitlist for social and affordable housing is much larger than the supply of units, and New York remains one of the most segregated metro areas in the country. The problem is that most governments fail to recognize that building of any housing will not happen unless developers cross a threshold of minimum profitability. Below that threshold, nothing will get built. However, there are costs associated with inclusionary zoning. In passing the cost of building affordable housing to developers, inclusionary zoning effectively raises the floor on the price for housing in order to earn a profit, as the other units basically have to subsidize the affordable ones. So the burden of the cost falls onto the renters and future home buyers. Much of the academic literature finds that inclusionary zoning can raise housing prices in jurisdictions that implement it. In one article for the Mercatus Center, a paper reviewed 6 studies that looked to measure the effects of inclusionary zoning on home prices, and they found that 4 out of the 6 studies concluded that inclusionary zoning actually raises prices. The only way to make housing affordable, in my opinion, is to create the incentives that make it attractive. In expensive cities, like say Toronto or New York, where land costs are so high it's difficult to deliver new construction for, let's say, even less than $1,000 a square foot, if you cut the development taxes and made land available at a reasonable price for an affordable product, you would find developers are willing and interested in creating affordable product. You need to understand the math that developers use when they look at a project. See, developers always have choices. They can choose to build or not to build. They can choose what to build. What they don't control is the cost of capital, and they don't control the market rents, and they don't control necessarily the cost of construction. I've seen a recent attempt at creating incentives for affordable development fall completely flat. The politicians simply didn't do the math. They offered a reduction in development impact fees that would lower the total project cost. The effect of lowering those costs would increase the net income by about $140 a month, all other things being equal. In exchange for that increase of $140 a month incentive, the developer would need to give up $500 a month in rent on those same units in order to fit into the affordable criteria. Well, no developer who knows how to use a calculator would ever make that choice. See, even if government tries to mandate the affordable housing, they have to remember at the end of the day, the decision to invest is still voluntary. Nobody is compelled to build a building in New York City or Toronto or Nashville or anywhere else. If the conditions are too difficult in Austin, developers might move to Charlotte. If it doesn't work in Dallas, they'll go to a suburb like, say, Arlington, where the environment is more developer-friendly. As you think about that, have an awesome rest of your day. Go make some great things happen, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.